we're going to open our Senate Committee on Education. Today is April 16th. Thank you all for being here. We're going to try to go on the order for a little bit. That has been rare here. Usually we move around all over the place. But we're going to start with a public hearing on Senate Bill, and some of these are carried over from the previous deal. So Senate Bill 860, and we'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Chair Rublin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 860 directs the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to select the University of Oregon or Oregon State University to design and develop a career advising and mentorship pilot program. This bill has no prior subsequent referral. We are considering the -1 amendments at this time.
So do we have our list from before who was going to be here? Because we started out. Okay, so Leslie Erickson and Jennifer Edwards, if they're here. Okay, come on up. We started yesterday, and Senator Edwards already spoke, so that's why we're just continuing the hearing.
Yep. Chair Roblin and members of the Education Committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. For the record, my name is Leslie Erickson. I am representing Oregon State University today, and I am the Career Services Director at the university. During the economic turndown of 2009, we saw a shrinking job market, growing student debt, and unavoidable questions about the value of a degree. Institutions of higher education realized the change was necessary and began to turn to their career centers to improve the return on investment for their students and their families. To address this change in the career landscape at Oregon State University, we have developed a new delivery model of career services that starts at orientation and continues through the graduate and on into their life and their career after education. This new model is developmental and very intentional in design, focusing each year on a new employability topic, with each topic serving as a foundation for the year to come. The new model creates a structured experience through which students explore their own knowledge, skills and values, the world of work, and how they're interested in making a contribution. They participate in experiential education opportunities and thus gain real-world experience while still in school. And lastly, the job search and career management experience they gain while in school helps them be competitive in today's market. Each step in the career development process corresponds to a wide variety of programs and services designed to prepare students to be competitive today, in today's job search process and in today's world of work. As with any good plan, we have desired outcomes and metrics to measure our progress. The ultimate measure of our success is the employability of our graduates. The framework for our plan is solid, but our resources are limited. Currently, there are 6 career consultants between my office and the OSU Alumni Connections Office. Working together, these 6 individuals serve 28,000 students who are currently enrolled and over 176,000 alumni. If we are to be selected as the pilot program described in Senate Bill 860, I have no doubt that the additional funding and the FTE would be immensely helpful for us in developing and continuing to develop this program and growing the number of students that we serve and the impact that we have potentially on their career management. At this point, I want to end my comments and thank you for the opportunity for speaking with you today, and would love to have the chance to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions for this witness? I guess what the question I would answer is that the idea of this one is to have this mentorship program.
Right.
So you're already starting to have the conversations with respect to what kind of income you could earn and those kinds of things with what you're saying in your old program. This would just supplement that.
Absolutely.
To give it the opportunity.
I think we shared as a handout something we call the Beaver Career Success Plan, and there's a program in there called ASK, Alumni Sharing Knowledge, which is a future to-be-developed program. I would say to you that in good faith we've launched this program and are in the very beginning stages of it with the hope that our good work leads to potential growth in the program. So while the mentoring program is already there conceptually, it is not fully developed. Even though we are using those resources, we don't have the resources to continue to grow the program to the point it needs to be to serve students.
Thank you for that information.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Are the positions created, are they just for the 15-17 biennium?
I believe they are, as is stated in the proposal.
Okay, so what happens follow-up question. In future biennial, what happens to those positions or the other institutions, and would they get funding as well?
I believe that the other institutions, if they're not selected, would receive no funding and unfortunately not benefit from this kind of program unless they have their own internal resources. And I believe that, I think the bill is written as if the funding would continue beyond 15-17, but only for the two institutions that are selected.
Thank you. Any other questions? Not seeing any. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
There's no one else who signed up to speak on Senate Bill 860. This is the public hearing. Is there anyone who just forgot and would love to come up and speak? Seeing none, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 860.
Question? So yes.
Senator Hatch.
Chair or Gretchen, who drafted the dash ones on this bill?
Yeah,
it was
been working
Senator.
In collaboration with
OSU.
Okay.
I can answer that question.
Oh, come on up.
Thank you.
One of the collaborators, yes.
Collaborator. Jock.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Jock Mills, Director of Government Relations for Oregon State University. It was a collaborative effort with Senator Edwards. Basically what we said when we saw the original bill, we said, this kind of looks like Mad Max. You have two schools enter, one school leaves. Not everybody gets to play in the game. And so what we wanted to do was open it up to both the regional, the true universities and one of the large universities and just create a request for a proposal and work that through Legislative Council and Senator Edwards.
Okay, thanks.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
Oregon State Day was a couple days ago.
Yeah, exactly. Any other testimony? Thank you for that question, actually. With that, we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 860. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 957, also a continuation from the other day. So Emily Nazaro and Iris Maria Chavez and Joel Fisher, come on up.
Senator Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Emily Nazarov. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Department of Education to speak to you about Senate Bill 957. In January of this year, the State Board adopted revisions to OAR 581-022-1620 required instructional time. I've submitted written testimony that explains the changes that were adopted and outlined the six-month rulemaking process that ODE and the State Board engaged in leading up to that. For purpose of this hearing, I'd like to explain two changes that would be impacted by Senate Bill 957. First, the new rule increased instructional time for grades K through 3 to bring those grades into alignment with instructional time requirements for grades 4 through 8. Under the new rule, K-3 instructional time was increased from 810 hours to 900 hours. The rule allows kindergarten through third grade to count up to 60 hours of recess towards their instructional time total. So really, we're talking about an increase of 30 hours. And based on information provided by districts as part of their 2013-14 Division 22 assurances, we believe 116 districts were already offering 900 hours at the K-3 or at the first through third grade level. The State Board did not increase instructional time for grades 4 through 8 or 9 through 12. Second, the new rule changes the way we measure compliance with minimum instructional time requirements. Under the old rule, a district was required to adopt a school calendar which provides its students with a minimum number of instructional time hours. The problem was that under that rule, a district could adopt a calendar that provided 8 classes totaling 990 hours, using high school as an example, but only offer students 6 or 7 classes. The district would technically be in compliance with the rule, but those students scheduled for 6 or 7 classes would be receiving far fewer hours than the 990. Under the new rule, we look at the actual hours a student is scheduled. Districts are required to ensure a certain percentage of students are scheduled to receive the minimum instructional hours. The rule provides for a 4-year phase-in of the requirement. In year one, districts have to ensure that 80% of students across the district are receiving the minimum number of hours. And by year four, they have to ensure that 92% of the students in the district and 80% of students at each school are receiving the minimum hours. Districts have a cushion for students who for some reason choose to have less than a full schedule, and the rule leaves it to the discretion of districts to decide what that looks like in their community. To give you some context, for a large district, a district could have all of the senior class and part of the junior class on a reduced schedule and meet the 92% benchmark. ODE and the board took into account that this would be a change for districts. ODE provided fiscal impact information to the board. The rule includes a four-year phase-in, and the rule directs the board to revisit the standards every January during the four-year phase-in. The board's required to hold a public hearing January 2016, 17, and 18 to receive information from districts about the instructional time standards. We do have some idea where districts stand in relation to the new requirements. In January 2015, school districts reported their Division 22 assurances to ODE. We asked districts to tell us where they stood in relation to these new requirements. Based on the information provided by districts, ODE believes that almost all districts currently meet the benchmarks for the first 2 years of implementation. That is, almost all districts currently have at least 85% of their students scheduled to receive the minimum instructional hours. ODE and the board engaged in a six-month process leading up to the board's adoption vote. I've outlined that process in my written testimony and would be happy to answer any questions you have. And the final rule really was impacted by stakeholder input. The final rule includes some elements that were not in our original proposal, but were advocated for by stakeholders. For example, the rule allows districts to count up to 30 hours of professional development and 30 hours of parent-teacher conferences in their instructional time totals. We've specifically addressed CTE time to make sure we're not discouraging CTE programs. And as I mentioned before, the rule counts 60 hours of recess for grades K through 3. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Iris Maria Chavez. I'm the Government Affairs Director with Stanford Children, Oregon. Here to speak with you in regards to Senate Bill 957. We at STAN believe that time in school is a really precious resource. As it's currently written, Senate Bill 957 would erode away what little time our students do spend in the classroom and would undermine the rules put in place by the Oregon State Board of Education last January. Our membership across the state worked very hard for a very long time to get to this place under the rulemaking process with the state board. We believe the legislation would be harmful for students across the state. We think there are many reasons for that. I'll outline a couple of them. And then what I would like to do is actually share some comments from our members, those who did work on this issue over the last year. As Emily mentioned, many districts are able to meet the instructional time requirements as outlined by the state rules with current funding. The data from the department showed us that for the high school levels, 150 districts are reporting between 932 and 1,049 instructional hours. And again, they're doing that at the current funding level. I would like to point out an interesting example. We have quite a number of members in the Eugene School District Area 4J. And I think this is an example that really highlights the issue that was at play and how we've solved that and why this bill could actually be detrimental. In 2011-2012 school year in 4J, 32% of freshmen were receiving a full schedule, meaning that these were students who in their freshman year were not on track to graduate within 4 or probably 5 years. Upon this coming to light by the advocacy of a number of community advocates, parents, and other students, the district decided to make an intentional choice. They decided to hire additional teachers to put in their comprehensive high schools. They hired 10 more teachers so that they could ensure that all students in their freshman year were getting a full course load. In just a short amount of time, they went from having the 32% of students scheduled for a full load to 73%. All with their current funding levels. We thank the district leadership for doing that, and we also know that in many other districts around the state, they're able to do that and are looking to do so. So what I'd like to do right now is share with you some of the comments from our members. We both worked with them in a survey method. They also provided quite a bit of testimony to the state board on this issue, and I think it would be really important for you to hear where they're coming from and why this issue is of such concern to them. A member from the Eugene area. My child does not have a full schedule. He couldn't get any desired classes that would help with aspiration for college. A member from our Reynolds district. It's very important for us as parents that our children are as long as possible in the classroom. Those hours of instruction our children receive are key to their academic development. Academic standards today are higher and tighter, therefore instructional time should be longer and more meaningful. A member from Salem told us that I've seen students encouraged to take less than a full schedule because they can, without understanding how a light schedule will affect their chances of getting into and being prepared for college. This particularly impacts children from under-resourced communities whose parents might not know the implications of a lighter schedule. A member from Eugene as well tells us that the first year my daughter was in high school, the superintendent made it a priority to ensure that all first-year high school students had a full schedule. That didn't continue in subsequent years. How can kids not have access to the courses they need to graduate? Another member from Eugene told us, as my daughter entered high school, I am shocked by the opportunities to miss school time. These are not structured study times, but free periods with no supervision. No wonder her high school is good, but has a 29% dropout rate. How is that acceptable? And finally, a member of ours from Portland area. My oldest is a freshman. During forecasting, he was emphatically encouraged to take a study hall. He had to opt out of that study hall. He had to sign a statement stating that taking a full load of classes would be challenging. It was surreal. I close with saying that we really feel strongly that Senate Bill 957 will erode both the good work of the State Board of Education as well as parents, students, and community advocates from around the country, that we owe it to our children to ensure that they're given the time in the classroom that will allow them to be successful.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Joel Fisher on behalf of the Oregon Business Association. We're a statewide association representing over 275 members across Oregon, both big and small, here to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 957. Oregon Business Association has long been a supporter of increased instructional time in our schools. We've heard some interesting arguments as to why a shorter school year might be better so that students can do things like work. I know from my own personal experience, I've been worked a 30-hour work week all through high school ever since I was old enough to work, and I don't think that we should be arguing for a shorter school year. Let me present some arguments why we should have a longer school year. There's a delicate balance of things that go into raising achievement in schools, things like teacher quality, the size of our classes, and the amount of instructional time. Obviously, there are some other factors, but we think that this bill would erode the good work that's been done by the department, and we're here to testify in support of even looking at how we can find ways to lengthen our school year and increase instructional time. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
I just have a couple. I mean, my first one has to do with right now there are a number of our schools that are cutting days, and so they don't meet the requirement oftentimes. So does anything happen to them when they don't meet the requirement? And does this would make it harder for some of those. They would just fall farther behind because they don't have the money to do that.
I can address that. Chair Roland, members of the committee, Emily Nazara for ODE. Currently, if a school for some reason had to cut their hours, there's two ways that this would come up. The first is, as part of their Division 22 assurances, they would report to the department that they are not going to meet the requirement for that year. Under the statute and rules, we would reach out to the district, ask them, what is your plan to be back into compliance by the following school year? They would submit a corrective action plan, and they would have until the following year to be back in compliance. The second way it would come up is the district could apply for a waiver from the State Board of Education, and they would ask for a waiver from that instructional time rule. The deputy superintendent would make a recommendation to the board, and the board would vote on it.
And I guess the other question is, if a student really felt they did need a study hall, would they then, and their sixth period or seventh period day, that wouldn't count. So would there be pressure on the administration or whoever to make sure that they took a class, even if they weren't going to be successful? Because I was a math teacher, and I will tell you, we had a really great math study hall where there was not an instructor, but a person that probably knew better than the math teachers. And every kid wanted to get into that classroom, especially when they got into higher math, because they always didn't always have time in the classroom to get the instruction. Would that then be part of the one that would take away from meeting the requirement?
No, I can answer that as well. Chair Roland, members of the committee, study hall time would be counted as instructional time if attendance is required and the student is receiving instructional assistance. A study hall that would not be counted as if you have 60 kids in a classroom with no instructional assistance provided and attendance is not required.
Okay. Any other questions about this bill? I will tell you my biggest concern is looking at what we're allegedly giving and what we're expecting, and all of a sudden we're expecting more with what some districts say is less. I believe it is actually a little bit more, but that's a here and there. But it's a concern of mine, and I will continue to have that conversation. But I appreciate your testimony. And I would love to go to a longer school year because I agree. I just think some kids spreading it out over a long period of time is much better for those kids. So a longer school year would be a really nice thing.
Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to speak to this bill, 957? Come on up. Otherwise, we are going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 957. And we will open a public hearing on SJR 18. So this dude, Senator Beyer, do you want to go out and there, or do you want to do it up here?
I got one. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Lee Beyer, State Senator from District 6, and talking about funding for education. We've certainly had a lot of discussion about talking for funding for education this time, and I think we've all heard a lot from our constituents about it. And I think we all agree that currently we are not coming anywhere close to the constitutional mandate of funding to the quality education model. As I've reflected on it and looked at it, my concern has been that, frankly, there just isn't the money there. We all know that to get to the QEM would require increasing the annual budget for education by an additional $2 billion, and frankly, we don't have that. What Senate Joint Resolution 18 does is it's very simple. It's a referral to the voters asking them, you know, we've heard you. Do you want to fund education or not? What the measure does very simply is it says, do you wish to fund a consumption tax with a capped level? And I was thinking in a neighborhood of 1 to 3%, nothing more than that, be constitutionally set. That would be totally funded to education, constitutionally that. Second feature of it is has a what we refer to as a maintenance of effort clause, which essentially would set a baseline general fund budget of whatever we establish this year, and future legislatures would be required to fund that constitutionally, that funding level out of the general fund, and then would add to it from the additional funds that would go into an educational grant fund. I've passed out, besides the resolution, a sheet from the Revenue Department that shows you what a sales tax or a business activity tax, both of which would fit the constitutional definition that's presented in this resolution. And roughly, if the voters were to establish it, if you were to establish a 1% sales tax based on the Washington model, you would generate roughly $1.3 billion a year, not biennium, but a year, towards supporting education. If you chose to use a business activity tax, which is something they use in Ohio, which is a strong manufacturing state, at a quarter of 1%, you would generate roughly the same amount of money. So I think there's some options there. I think you hear a lot that the voters have rejected a sales tax 9 times. That's true. We've never put one in front of them that was constitutionally restricted and dedicated solely to education. And in this case, and in the past, we've also tried to put forward, I think, as an attempt to describe all of the features of it, very complex sales tax proposals, which provide lots of opportunities for people to disagree on one of the many features of it. What this does basically is what I think is asked the appropriate constitutional question was, do you want to do this? And if you do, you set the cap, and then the legislature will define how to get there. That's an appropriate role for the legislature, and I think it's something I'm not asking the legislature to vote to do it. I'm asking the legislature to refer to the voters and say, do you want to fund education? It's as simple as that. I think Mr. Chair, I acknowledge that this is something that needs to go down to the Senate Finance Committee. I know Senator Hass, as chair of that committee, is working on a number of different proposals down there, and I'd be very supportive of whatever comes out of there.
Okay, any questions?
Mr. Chair, I would just thank Senator Beyer for thinking along these lines. It's true, we do have some issues down there that we're looking at along these same lines, commercial activity tax, tax reform ideas, and by the time the session is out, I think we will have some of these, whether it's a referral or not, or both, or a package. We need to start talking more about this because there is a very strong link between our fair tax system and a strong educational system. On the sales tax itself, the last time, you're right, it was voted down 9 times, but the last time it was voted down was in 1993, which was before the internet.
Yeah.
Things have changed a little bit since then.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hass, I would want to remind people who tell me that the sales tax went down 9 times. The income tax went down 9 times in Oregon before it was finally enacted.
Yes, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Senator Beyer, do you have any estimate what 1% would generate, a 1% sales tax?
What it generates? Yeah, I thought I passed out a piece of paper, a matrix that has it there. If you look down, about halfway down, there's a heading that says sales tax, and it lists a number of different forms of that.
Oops, I got it now.
You got it now. Okay. A 1% based on the Washington model, and that's the one most people are familiar with, is projected to generate $660 million.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Okay.
Thank you very much.
We also have Tim Cowan.
Chair and committee members, I provided written testimony back in about, it was close to June of 2013, didn't get a response, so I put it in the paper. At that time, it was Senate Joint Resolution 36 was introduced, and it was talking about amending the Oregon Constitution for a sales tax. This would not be the first time, which is mentioned before, about 9 times. So I'm neither for nor against a sales tax, but I want the questions answered. One, what is the state trying to achieve with a sales tax, which was mentioned with education? Is the additional tax revenue necessary to meet current and or future needs? And is the current or new requirements discretionary? Two, what efforts have been made to control or reduce revenue requirements? Are the new requirements for funding necessary or merely a lack of establishing priorities? How will the voters be assured these additional funds won't postpone the need to address expenditures? Three, is there any efficiencies that can be achieved with the arrival of new revenues? Does this new revenue reduce the state government's need to be accountable for expenditures? Four, how much of the future needs for funding are a result of new requirements placed on existing programs? Does the sales tax only reflect the state's lack of accountability, the lack of commitment, and or the capacity to create solutions? Six, how will the voters be convinced the state will be held accountable if they can merely increase revenue to make up for the lack of commitment to the best decisions for all parties? I'll skip the other. Seven, what options are available to increase revenue other than a sales tax? Is a sales tax preferred because it gives the state an immediate boost in revenue? Eight, does a constitutional amendment give the state the authority to tax Oregonians at will without requiring voter approval? How will the taxpayers be assured that the sales tax is not merely a stopgap? Will there be continued efforts to raise more revenue from different sources? Nine, why have voters in the past voted against the amendment? Have the voters rejected this amendment because they believe the sales tax is nothing more than additional revenue to solve perceived problems as opposed to reducing expenditure? It's hard to hold state accountable if they can just increase revenue to make up for the lack of commitment to the best decisions for all parties. Will the revenue from sales tax be shared with local government, and how will local government be held accountable for both increased revenues and expenditures when funds are provided from the state without condition? The sales tax may be the last method for voters to hold all levels of government accountable. I think if we can address those questions, we'll improve the ability to have the voters get involved with the sales tax. And as mentioned before, in that time, we were one of five that didn't have a sales tax.
So I'll take a stab at explaining to you that the process will include coming to grips with some of those questions, and I know that my Republican colleagues and my Democratic colleagues take all of those seriously. If you were to just use one measure, especially in the education realm, we have a quality education model that says if you do these things, you should expect these results, and this is what it would cost. And we currently in education are there, the recommendation that comes from that, we're about $1.8 billion short. So that's difficult to get that kind of, if that is true, if that's the right standard, there's a lot of people who would disagree that it is, there's others that would say it is the right method, they would say that would be a difficult amount to pull out of just tightening up the issues. And this actually, depending on what level you set, wouldn't matter. This bill, I think from what the testimony was, gives voters to say they're willing. It would still have to come through the legislature to answer each of those questions about how much do you put in the rate. All of those kinds of things are something that's different. The difference on this particular one is that the money coming from it was dedicated to education only. So, but you have a great list of questions that need to be asked every time we make a bill here. Anytime. So,
may I?
Yes, please.
Sir, there was a statement made there would be a cap put on that. Well, the issue is, if you got me to vote for that, how do I know that won't be changed down the road by a different group of people?
Depends on whether they put it in constitutionally or not. And Senator Byers gone, so I'll have to remember if it was a constitutional cap or not. But, yeah, it is a constitutional cap. So once that's decided, it would be a constitutional cap, and then you'd have to go back to the voters if you wanted to change it.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions or people that want to take a shot at answers? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate you coming. There's no one else who has signed up at this point to talk to this bill, so we're going to close our public hearing on SJR 518, and we'll open a public hearing on SB 702. And hopefully, are the people here we need to have here? Is this one we've done before? Okay. So with that, we'll have a short explanation by our administrator and
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 702 specifies that aggregate total hours worked by part-time faculty member at more than one public institution of higher education shall be considered in determination of full-time status of faculty member for health care coverage. We do have -1 amendments to this bill.
Oh, Senator Dembro, come on up. You just appeared magically.
I was just next door. All right. Thanks, Chair Roblin, committee members. Michael Dembro, Senate Bill 23, Northeast, Southeast Portland, here to speak about Senate Bill 702, which has to do with access to health benefits for part-time faculty. I think you're all well aware of the way that higher education has been changing in terms of moving more and more into reliance on part-time teachers to teach the bulk of instruction. You know, we've had part-timers, you know, for a long, long time in our universities and particularly our colleges, and their initial purpose was to bring real-world expertise to subjects. These are people who were working their day job, exercising their expertise, and then would come in the evening to share their expertise with students. And that is a great thing. We still have many part-timers who do that, and they're really providing a service. It's, you know, almost a kind of a form of public service that they're doing. But increasingly, we're seeing core areas of the curricula being taught by people who are really working full-time. They are full-time teachers. They're full-time faculty, but their teaching is split up over two or more institutions, right? So they'll be teaching a couple of classes at Portland State University, a couple of classes at Portland Community Colleges, a couple of classes at Mount Hood Community College. In fact, many of them are teaching not only at levels approaching full-time, but exceeding full-time. They really are full-time employees of the delivery of higher education in this state. In recognition of that, the legislature back in, I think it was 1989, extended PERS benefits to people who were in this situation. You know, that is, those who were working at a PERS eligible level, but their employment was distributed over two or more institutions. And that has been the practice ever since then, ever since the program got underway in the early 90s. In 2009, the legislature passed House Bill 2557, which allowed part-timers the combination of whose hours made them eligible for those PERS benefits to also be eligible for OEB, the Oregon Educator Benefit Board, where they could purchase a plan, generally a high deductible plan because it was more affordable. They would have to do it on a self-pay basis. Today, colleagues, we're in the world of the Affordable Care Act, right? And there is, as part of that act, there is a recognition that employers have responsibility to cover their employees to some extent. And, we are just seeing, I think, this year and next year, the rollout of what's called the employer mandate. And, you know, the question is, you know, should those who are teaching at a substantial level, at levels approaching full-time or exceeding full-time, not be considered employees for this purpose? And so to that end, we have Senate Bill 702, which is an attempt to deal with this in a very practical way. And essentially what it would do is it takes the program that we set up in Senate Bill 702, in House Bill 2557 in 2009, and it calls on the institutions to share in the premium costs for the employees who meet this threshold. And the way that we have it envisioned in the bill, the premium cost, the employee would pick up 10% of that cost, and the employers would share the remaining 90% in a prorated way. This would be done in a look back, which is how PERS does its thing now. The end of the year, they do a look back and see, okay, looking back, did that individual reach the threshold, in which case benefits will be paid. Here, the way this is set up, if they met the threshold in the previous year, then they would be covered for the year to come. So the first year they would not be covered. It would always be retroactive. And so that's, you know, that's really pretty much what the bill is and what it does. You know, I've met with PERS and OEB, and they feel very comfortable implementing this. This would be OEB already has the process set up for the self-pay, and, you know, they feel that it would be very easy for them to turn this into a prorated assessment, you know, for the year to come. Colleagues, I hope that you will, you know, seriously entertain this this program. I'm hoping, I haven't had a chance yet to sit down with HR people from the different institutions together with PERS and OEB in order to get implementation questions answered. But I'd be happy to do that. And in fact, I look forward to doing that. And that, you know, it may require this bill to go to rules, actually, after this in order to give us the time to do that. Because I want to get this to a point where the institutions understand just what a narrow horizon of people it is that we're talking about. We got a printout from PERS of the people who would be covered by this. And it's a very interesting list. It's about 570 people who are eligible for PERS strictly because they are working at multiple institutions. And that is the group of people that this bill is intended to deal with. It's not intended to deal with those who are working less than full-time at a single institution. It's just focused, or the intent of it anyway, is just to be focused on those who are reaching that that threshold through a combination of their teaching at multiple institutions. You know, I think that at the end of the day, this would probably cover something like 200 or 300 people that would need this coverage, which again would be split out among the different institutions. So with that, I'd be very, very happy to answer any questions that you might have about the bill, about the reason for it, and about the way that the process would work.
Any questions? Yes, Senator Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, I know there's people move a lot. I know I have a number of friends who are teaching at more than one community college, yeah, which I suppose this is where this happens most. What happens if they're full-time one term and then it drops another term? Does this allow for a movement back and forth? Or I'm just trying to think of the administration of that.
Sure. Senator Roblin, Senator Byer. Yeah, that's, you know, remember, we're working off of a system that it is in place and has been in place for a couple of decades. And what they do is at the end of the year, they look at the total hours worked. So it's not by term. It's the total, actually, it's generally done through the number of courses and the FTE that, you know, relative to what a full-timer is a full load for the full-timer. And each institution sets its own PERS threshold, by the way. So they're not actually identical. It's how each institution, you know, they may have different collective bargaining agreements. They may have just different workloads. The workload of a full-timer at Western Oregon is not the same as at U of O, for example. So each one does it its own way. At the end of the year, PERS does a look back and adds up all those hours. And if it hits the threshold, then the person is eligible. So it's essentially the way it plays out is a person who is teaching something like 0.6 of a full-time load over the previous year becomes eligible.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So Tracy Hodgson, Donna Chastain, and John Kopp. Forward.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the Senate Education Committee. My name is Tracy Hodson, and I am a history instructor at Chemeketa Community College. I live in Portland, Oregon. I'm the president of the Faculty Association at Chemeketa Community College and the secretary of the Oregon Education Association Community College Council. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 702 to allow part-time faculty to receive much-needed health care benefits. I'm a full-time faculty member, and I have the good fortune to receive health care benefits. I have confidence if one of my children is injured or falls ill, I can take them to the doctor. If I need medical care, I can seek it without fearing that bankruptcy might be looming. But many of my part-time faculty colleagues are not so fortunate. Community colleges and universities in Oregon and across the nation are increasingly relying on part-time faculty to teach their students. Possessing master's or PhD degrees, but forced to accept part-time employment. Part-time faculty seek to piece together a living by teaching at multiple institutions. So the reality is that many of these so-called part-time faculty actually teach full-time or close to full-time. They just happen to teach classes at multiple institutions. I work with several of these faculty, these road scholars, we call them, R-O-A-D, who travel up and down the freeway or highway between workplaces as they teach students at multiple institutions. Many live near the poverty level as they pursue their passion for educating the next generation of workers or citizens. And many, if not most, have trouble accessing or affording health care benefits for themselves and the families they support. You may have seen recent headlines of a University of California Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education report that found that 25% of part-time faculty in California are forced to access some form of public assistance to make ends meet. Based on my knowledge of part-time faculty in Oregon, it's likely that's the case in our state as well. So Senate Bill 702 seems a common sense and frankly overdue remedy for public servants who have been senselessly cut out of receiving a basic workplace right simply because they split their time between more than one institution. This bill still requires faculty to pay a portion of their health care and an even larger percentage for their family's health care, but it will offer them much needed security. You have before you an opportunity to address a serious problem, to right a wrong, and to allow hardworking professional educators to serve our public institutions to receive the health care commensurate with the amount of time they work. So please pass Senate Bill 702 and help part-time faculty and their families receive the health care benefits they need and deserve. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Donna Chastain, HR Director at Oregon State University, and I'm here today to speak on behalf of all of the seven public institutions. So thank you, Chair Roblin, and members of the committee. On behalf of the seven institutions, we are in support of the goal of Senate Bill 702, which enables us to work with community colleges and our own institutions in aggregating FTE for employees that work in the multiple institutions. And also, the Senate bill decreases the FTE associated with benefits threshold. It's decreasing the threshold from 0.5 FTE to 0.3 FTE, but our support relies on the adequate funding of the bill. To simply mandate that benefits be aggregated and thresholds be lowered without providing adequate state funding would create a new cost that would be borne by our students through tuition increases. Our desire is to implement a comprehensive health benefit program that is equitable, administratively sound, and financially sustainable. The financial impact will vary amongst the institutions based on the number of part-time faculty we employ and the proximity to community colleges. The universities are currently developing a fiscal impact analysis, but we thought it would be helpful for the committee to have an idea of a couple of the estimates we currently have. Portland State currently estimates they have the highest financial impact and currently estimates impact based on the number of employees and the proximity to three community college systems to be approximately $10 to $12 million over the biennium to cover approximately 400 to 500 employees. They would also require an additional FTE to administer the expanded program. Oregon State estimates our cost at approximately $2.4 to $3 million to provide coverage for approximately 160 employees impacted by the bill, and would also require an additional FTE to administer the program. We are also concerned that the bill may seem as creating inequities among employee populations at each institution because it applies only to teaching faculty. It does not apply to professional and research faculty or to classified employees who work at least 0.3 FTE or may also work at multiple institutions. Whether or not those employees are included in the bill, passage of the bill would create a rightful expectations that aggregated benefits ought to be extended to other employee classifications. In addition to our financial impacts and equity concerns, there's a number of complex administrative challenges that could result and in unintended consequences. This includes creating incentives for institutions to reduce hours for employees in order to avoid the financial burden of providing benefits. But our sincere interest is to ensure that the bill is implemented in a way that provides equitable benefits for employees who are working similar hours. Because of the complexities involved in developing and implementing and funding a program to bring equitable health insurance to part-time faculty, we support a deliberate and careful considered approach. If you embark on this process, all seven universities are committed to working together with community colleges and our other partners, including PEB or OEB, PERS, and the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, to develop a coordinated approach that addresses the challenges we know exist or may not have discovered yet. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is John Kopp, and I'm a 57-year-old full-time instructor and department chair at Columbia Gorge Community College. A year ago last February, I developed a heart condition that mimicked something serious, determining it wasn't life-threatening, but did require a procedure to remove some cells in my heart that were causing it to behave abnormally, cost more than $50,000 in hospital bills. As a full-time instructor, I enjoy employer-provided health care benefits that picked up most of the cost. That didn't save my life, but it did save me from potential bankruptcy. 10 years ago, I was still working as an adjunct instructor. At that time, I taught at CGCC, Tillamook Bay Community College, Portland Community College, Clark College in Washington, Linfield, and anywhere else I could get a job. The work at Tillamook Bay and CGCC was pretty steady, and with what I could pick up elsewhere, I usually taught between 19 and 20 credits per term. That's a 25% greater load than I'm asked to carry as a full-time instructor now. I still struggle to make ends meet. When my expenses rose as they did in November's, when property taxes came due, I was forced to seek additional work. That work ran from bartending to installing phone books at public phones. And while that work helped me make ends meet, none of it provided benefits. As an adjunct instructor, I was ineligible for any benefits despite carrying a greater instructional load than did my full-time brethren. I was fortunate for most of my life. I have enjoyed good health. A medical issue like the one I had last year could cost me my home. I certainly didn't have the financial flexibility to be able to handle a problem like that when I was driving from college to college and struggling to make ends meet. By providing me to access to health coverage, a bill like SB 702 likely would have been a lifesaver and a financial godsend. As the president of the faculty and staff union at CGCC, I know that many of my colleagues are still facing the struggle to make ends meet and the fear that a health catastrophe will ruin them financially or worse. I urge you to pass SB 702 and bring access to health coverage in line with retirement benefits here in the state of Oregon. You'll be taking another step towards fairness and compensation and another step away from the exploitation of adjunct instructors in Oregon's public education sector. Thank you for your time and listening to my story.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you all. So, Robert Troyer, Mark Perlman, and Matoya Nakamura.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Rob Troyer. I'm an associate professor of linguistics at Western Oregon University. Thank you for allowing us to be here and talk to you. I'll keep my comments simple. I'm in the English department at Western, the Department of English Writing and Linguistics. We have 14 tenured or tenure track faculty members and about 12 to 13 non-tenure track or adjunct faculty members, depending on the term. Most of our adjuncts teach full-time, but not all of them. We don't always have enough classes for all of them. I know at least two who would easily qualify for this. They teach maybe two or three classes a year at Western, and they teach other classes at Chemeketa, and they would not have benefits at Western, but with combined hours at two or more institutions, they would. To me, that seems like a simple decision to bring it in line with PERS benefits. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Mark Perlman. I'm a professor of philosophy at Western Oregon University, and I'm also the president of the faculty union at Western. And we are also in favor of this bill. I'll just give you a specific example of my colleague in philosophy who lives in Springfield, drives up to Monmouth over an hour each way to teach in Monmouth, and has at times, when we didn't have enough courses for him, also taught at PSU, and then drove back to Springfield in the evening. And this is just the kind of person who, when they have to split their time among different campuses, would, if they're below 0.5 at any one of them, not get benefits. I mean, the upshot, I think, is that these people are all teaching full-time for the state of Oregon. And whether they're at one campus or multiple campuses really doesn't change the fact that they're devoting their careers to educating the citizens of Oregon. And it's a sort of technical difficulty of the fact that they split their time, that they're not getting the benefits that they would have normally gotten. And many of these people teach more than what we would consider full time. The reason they do that is Oregon universities and colleges pay these part-timers less than they pay tenured and tenure-track faculty. We're already in a situation where we're using these part-time and non-tenure-track faculty. In a sense, they're exploited labor. We're paying less for their services than we should be and that we do for tenured and tenure-track faculty. And we all know what's been happening to the budgets of higher education institutions. We know why that is. But we are getting away with paying people less for basically the same work and also paying them less in the sense of fewer benefits. And it seems simply unfair that we would be penalizing highly educated people. These are people with masters and PhDs. And the only reason that they're getting no benefits is because they're splitting their time among different campuses. Now, I know that we are breaking up the Oregon University system, but the HEC governs all the colleges and universities. And so the main point is, it seems to us to be an issue of fairness and a sort of moral obligation that we have to people that are spending their careers working for higher education in Oregon, that the least we could do is give them the benefits that they would get just the same if they were full-time at one campus. So we're strongly in favor of this bill, and I urge you to support it. Although I have to also agree with the person that spoke earlier, it won't do us much good to pass the bill if the colleges and universities don't get the funds to pay for the bill. And so I don't know the details of that, but I think we'd be disappointed to have the mandate without the funding. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. And my name is Motoya Nakamura of Portland, Oregon. And I have two children, 11 and 14. And I have been teaching at both Portland State University and Portland Community College since I lost my job as a full-time staff photographer at the Oregonian due to the layoffs in 2013, September. And during the last academic year, 2013 to 14, I taught six classes. for Portland Community College and two classes for PSU. And I would have been eligible for healthcare if the combined total FTE number of the eight classes I taught at the both institutions had been counted for the healthcare benefit. And still I was not able to be eligible for the healthcare benefit due to the fact I worked for the two separate public institutions. And during this academic year, fortunately, I was able to teach enough classes for the Portland Community College to be eligible for the healthcare benefit for the next year. But I wouldn't have been eligible if I had lost one or two classes for this term. And how many classes I'm able to teach depends heavily on enrollment, which fluctuates every year, every term. And I could lose a class or two a couple weeks before each term starts. As a matter of fact, I lost one this term, and it just happens, you know, here and there. And considering higher education in institutions use more adjunct faculty than the past, it would be great for adjunct faculty to be able to feel more secure about their future. And I know many adjunct faculty are in the same boat as me, patching different classes from different institutions together to in order to make living and take care of their family. And this Senate Bill 702, an amendment, will give adjunct faculty more and much needed security. I just wanted you to hear. Thank you so much.
Very nice. Any questions for this group? No. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next we have Daniel Hall and John Wyckoff. I apologize, Daniel, for skipping over you for a second, but come on up now.
Chair Roblin, members of committee. My name is Dan Hall. I'm a part-time adjunct sociology instructor at Columbia Gorge Community College. In 2009, Money Magazine provided their take on 50 of the best jobs in America. Ranked number 3, the college professor was on the list. They spouted median salaries of around $70,000. They also reported job satisfaction, flexibility, and contribution to society, all as being very high. I remember reading articles like that from Money Magazine in graduate school and feeling excited to enter the field of academia with a hope that I would be financially secure also with healthcare benefits. Some 12 years ago, I started a journey to one day fulfill my dream in teaching sociology. Nearly 2 years ago, that dream was realized at Columbia Gorge Community College. It took applying for positions across the nation, selling a house, paying thousands of dollars in moving expenses from Michigan to Oregon, and leaving my family and friends to do it, but nonetheless, it came a reality. Though I would not trade my career or passion for teaching for the world, it is important to note inaccuracies of the promised career that Money Magazine and other sources led it to be. I came to realize that the reality of instructors in today's world mirrored reality of many Americans. Many today have seen good paying and benefit providing jobs go to the wayside in favor of part-time jobs that cut costs and increase profit maximization. An academic sector is no different. As corporate CEOs live lavishly and financially secure, their part-time employees struggle to get by. This mirrors part-time academic faculty and their relation to presidents and higher-ups of their colleges. Today, at least 70% of all faculty members nationwide are part-time or adjunct. 70% of the nation's instructors of higher education cannot find the security of full-time jobs to offer them health care benefits and pay to make it in our society. This is a staggering amount and should be questioned when we think about a strong infrastructure in our higher educational institutions. Currently, I have health care benefits through my wife. However, the premium to add me to her plan is substantially more than if it was just herself. Furthermore, this has not always been the case. Since moving to Oregon, we have had instances of not having health insurance. This provided large amounts of stress and anxiety to us both, It's also deterred us from experiencing the beauty that is Oregon's wildlife and great outdoors in order to increase our health risk aversion. Recently, I have and am continuing to search for multiple teaching positions at local community college to offset this cost. If I was able to find another position and Senate Bill 702 passed, not only would I be able to receive financial relief, it would also provide a more affordable option to cover myself, in turn helping my family. Presently, I find myself lucky, as many of my peers are stuck trying to further develop our students and help society, all while living in fear. Fear that if something medically happens to them, they will either go bankrupt or be turned away from medical institutions because of lack of adequate health care, possibly resulting in disability or worse. By passing Senate Bill 702, it would be a step in the right direction in Oregon to rebuild rebuild and properly protect not only higher education, but the citizens that make up its infrastructure. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, John Wyckoff with the Oregon Community College Association. And in part, I want to sort of echo, I think, a lot of what you heard from our colleagues at the universities. We want to be a productive part of, should we move forward with this, of making this happen, of working with the Oregon Educator Benefit Board, as well as the universities, to make sure that this is done in an equitable way. And I really think it highlights the fact that, right, I mean, throughout the recession, and generally when times get tough in Oregon, we turn to the colleges and universities for their ability to raise tuition on students. And we have, throughout every recession, disinvested in our colleges and universities. And we generally talk about the effect that has on students through raising of tuition and the cutting of services. And what we probably don't also talk about enough is the effect that has had on our staff and faculty, who have been throughout the recession to kind of keep classes going. We're working longer hours. We're not getting raises. We're not getting kind of the normal cost of living, sort of cost of living adjustments that you often get. We're being asked to do more, and so when we're being forced to cut like that, we don't have a lot of good choices to make. You have to, I think a good perspective is, or context is, at the beginning of the recession in 2007, the Community College Support Fund, which is our major piece of funding, was $500 million. We got throughout the recession down to $395 million, which we compensated for by raising tuition and putting further pressure on our employees. And that is the sort of the effect of these major disinvestments in higher education. And so as we move forward looking at this, it is, I think, critical that the legislature step up and make an investment to move in this direction, because our only option will be, again, to go back to sort of the tuition well and either raise the costs on students or look for it in other parts of the colleges by putting the squeeze on some other group of employees. And that is not something that we think would probably be good for campus relations or good for the running of the campuses. But I think we would urge, like the universities, for you, for the legislature to step up and make an investment in a direction like this, rather than just making it another unfunded mandate that essentially students would end up paying for through tuition increases or through some other sort of negative adjustment within the college. And with that, I will close.
Okay. Any questions for any of these? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to speak to Senate Bill 702? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 702 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 950. So we will call up Thomas Manis, Judith Schein, and Krishna Christina McNitt. And we'll kind of do a short explanation of the bill and I'll be getting ready.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 950 appropriates monies for the biennium beginning July 1st, 2015 to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission for Oregon State University Operation of Center for Manufacturing and Design of Advanced Wood Products.
Go right ahead.
Thank you very much. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Thomas Manis. I'm Dean of the College of Forestry at Oregon State University. And I'd like to thank you very much for this opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 950. I've submitted written testimony which describes the research that would be conducted by the Institute in detail, the organizational structure, the facility, and the outcomes. And I'd just like to say a few words summarizing that, and be brief if I may. For the last 20 years, we've debated about how to increase employment in our rural communities as a result of reductions in timber harvest. And many of those debates involve how can we increase harvest from federal forests, and we know the frustration of trying to get there. This is an opportunity that allows us to increase the manufacturing jobs that we have with the existing harvest that we have. There's no other opportunity that I'm aware of that's like this. And as I've testified here before, I think the single most important measure that we can look at is the number of jobs that we produce per 1,000 board feet that we harvest from our forests. And this is an opportunity to increase this. And not only that, but these types of manufacturing jobs are family, wage-paying jobs that will be located in rural communities, communities like Sweet Home and Oak Ridge, that really need this opportunity. In addition, this produces sustainable buildings, for, not just for the Northwest, but for the world. This is an opportunity to export Oregon's high-value products to the rest of the world. I'd like to point out that this is not about building a competitive edge for the wood products industry against concrete or some or any other industry. This industry in tall wood buildings is going to happen. It's happening worldwide. It's very big in Asia, in Australia, in Europe, and in Canada. It's coming to the United States in a big way. We already have projects announced in Oregon. The question is, where is the industry going to develop in the United States? And this opportunity gives us opportunity to create that competitive edge for the wood products industry here in Oregon. And we can choose to accept that challenge, or we can watch somebody else develop it, and we can provide raw materials to that industry located elsewhere. I think this is just an opportunity that's too good to pass up, and the opportunity is now. It's not 2 years from now. It'll be too late by that time to seize the day on this one. Senate Bill 950 creates recurring funds that will create an applied research center to develop and test materials and methods for tall wood buildings produced from Oregon's wood products. The bill itself identifies lottery funds as a possible funding source for this. We're ambivalent about the source of those funds. They could come from other funds as well. But I think I'll stop there, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have at the conclusion of our testimony.
I can go ahead.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, and members of the committee. My name is Judith Schein. I'm the head of the Architecture Department at the University of Oregon. As you know from the proposal, we've both submitted testimony on behalf of this bill. This is a collaborative effort between OSU's College of Forestry and College of Engineering and the School of Architecture and Allied Arts at the University of Oregon. As you probably know, OSU's College of Forestry is number one in forestry in the U.S., and our Department of Architecture at UO is number one in the U.S. in sustainable design. Together with the College of Forestry, Architecture, and OSU's College of Engineering, we have a unique opportunity to link the expertise of wood science, architecture, and engineering to address the entire supply chain, connecting research, manufacturing, design and engineering research, construction, and advanced manufacturing. Already we have a number of demonstration projects going on. OSU's wood scientists are doing research that informs and creates new products and helps Oregon manufacturers produce new engineered wood products like cross-laminated timber. Lech Mijinski, who's an associate professor at the College of Forestry and Wood Science and Engineering, is working with Valerie Johnson at D.R. Johnson & Riddle to produce the first structural cross-laminated timber panels made in the United States, which we're all very excited about. And we've been doing, at UO, we've been doing design research based on those panels We have developed a CLT modular classroom in collaboration with Modern Building Systems in Elmsville, Oregon, and we're working on a mass timber parking garage in Springfield, Oregon, with Christine Lumberg, with the mayor, and with community development people there, which we're very excited about. And that would be a groundbreaking project because there aren't any mass timber parking garages in the U.S. at the moment, so we're developing what we hope will be the first one. We also have provided in our testimony some letters of support from architects in Oregon, including the AIA, the American Institute of Architects, Oregon chapter, the entire state of Oregon chapter, and also from the AIA Southwest Oregon chapter based in Eugene, who are all very excited about this initiative and looking forward to the possibility of working with new wood products after they are developed and tested by the new research center. And I'd also be happy to answer any questions you have.
Any questions for these two? Mm-hmm. The one thing I want to point out, and just to say, because I really appreciate the two of you up here having this conversation, is that we went to independent boards at each of our universities, and I have seen more collaboration happening between universities since we did that than when they were all in the same system. So I just want to point out that I'm really happy to see
that
both of
you. Thank
you,
Senator.
Good. Thank you.
Yeah,
thank
we're
you.
Very proud to be working together on this initiative.
Yeah, I'm excited about it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
So next we will have Christina McNitt, Dylan Cruz, and Christine Lundberg. Come on up.
So I think I'm the designated first hitter here. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt, and I represent the Oregon Forest Industries Council. Through the miracle process of photosynthesis, forests use the power of the sun to combine carbon dioxide and water into complex hydrocarbon chains that compose trees, while at the same time releasing oxygen back into the air. So think about that for a minute. Forests, utilizing nothing but solar power, combine carbon dioxide, CO2, a greenhouse gas, and water into complex hydrogen and carbon sugar chains of which trees are made. And then it releases oxygen back into the atmosphere. And nature does it all for free. Wood is organic, sustainable, natural, long, lightweight, flexible, and renewable. I meant to say strong, but with cross-laminated timber, it's also long. Oregon has the best tree-growing land in the world for growing our native species, Douglas fir, which also happens to be the world's premier softwood lumber species. This is an exciting time for Oregon's forest products industry. Oregon is already the number one softwood lumber and plywood producing state in the United States, and it's home to one of the world's most sustainable and globally competitive forest product sector. But we can do more. We need to continue to build on that reputation by advancing research in forestry and new wood products, technologies, and design, while promoting more extensive use of sustainable green Oregon forest products in domestic and global markets. Oregon State University College of Forestry, I always call it the College of Forestry, is internationally recognized as one of the premier forestry schools in the world. And I'm not just saying that because Dean Manis is behind me. The Oregon State University Department of Engineering and the University of Oregon School of Architecture and Allied Arts are national leaders in the green building field. By providing $3.4 million in lottery funding, or any other funding you may choose, Senate Bill 950 would help fund the development with one-to-one matching dollars of the National Center for Advanced Wood Products Manufacturing and Design. This is a one-of-a-kind collaboration between these universities and other public and private sector participants will create synergies that result in a powerful partnership cementing Oregon's position as a national leader. And I can tell you there are other states and universities looking to do getting into this business, but not like this proposal. The market opportunities are enormous. It's estimated that worldwide some 3 billion people will require new housing in the next 20 years. And a large share of that need will be from Asia. With the development of this center, Oregon's ideally situated to take advantage of the market development and provide sustainable building products to Asian markets on an unprecedented scale. Domestically, expanding markets and use of Oregon wood creates jobs, sustains rural economic vitality, increases energy independence, and encourages retention of private forest lands in private use.
and forest use, all while reducing carbon in the atmosphere and providing clean water, wildlife habitat, recreation opportunities, and the multitude of other social and ecosystem services that flow through Oregon's forests. It's an historic opportunity. I'm delighted that you're considering the bill, and OFIC offers its full support. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you. I am Christine Lundberg. I'm the mayor of Springfield, Oregon. I am here to talk to you in support of Senate Bill 950. I started on this journey thinking, gosh dang it, how are we going to get more jobs? We are a timber state. Traditionally, we have gone to the point where it's a struggling industry, but we're still very much a forest-based industry state. How can we do that? So then I went to, advanced wood. So then I went to, we should do one. So do something with advanced wood, and we have to do a parking structure anyway because we're redeveloping an underutilized industrial area that's smack dab between Springfield and Eugene. It's called Glenwood, and I'm about to go and receive an award from the American Planning Association for that redevelopment that we have planned in our refinement plan. But part of it is a parking structure, so we have to do it anyway. So why not do it in something that not only highlights what we can do with our wood products that are now we're working on, but that area can become a demonstration area for the state so that we can do something about the jobs that we want for our state and to do something about the economy. So I'm very excited about the idea that we're advancing it, and I can guarantee you, I just came from a small log conference, and we are definitely not the only state that's looking at capitalizing and being at the head of the line. And we are perfectly poised to be at the head of the line because we do have two universities that are very keen on working together and creating this. So I'm very excited to see what the students, there's nothing like students to create a structure for you and go, whoa, look at that, look what they did. So I'm very excited about what they can do, but there's so much more that we can do. And this facility, the National Center for Advanced Wood Products, would be able to put us on the map and put us at the head of the line. And we just, at the state level, we were just granted a Investing in Manufacturing Communities Partnership. It was Senate Bill 482, and the governor signed it, so that recognition is already here. Inside it is the advanced wood products is part of that manufacturing cluster, and if we get that federal designation, that will just advance it a little more for us. So I'm very excited at the potential. I can't wait for us to be able to do this, and so I very much encourage you to help us with the partnerships that we need, because gosh dang it, I forgot the part about building codes and fire codes and all the other things. So I'll work on that end. Mm-hmm. But the schools need to be able to make our products the best and get us where we are the world leader in terms of advanced wood products. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dylan Cruz. I am the policy director at Sustainable Northwest and the coordinator of the Western Juniper Alliance, something I've spoken with many of you about in other committees. Sustainable Northwest is very pleased to see and support Senate Bill 950. This is a great bill. I definitely want to reiterate everything we've heard here from Dean Manis and from Christina and these committees up here. This one checks all the boxes for us for an organization focused on sustainable natural resource use and rural community economic development. And when we talk about mass timber and we talk about architects getting excited about the future of these products and glue lam and cross-laminated timber, I always think it's funny because we have these discussions here in Oregon at conferences. They get in their car and they drive up to Washington and they have the exact same discussion. And they talk about how they're going to do it there. And Canada's already doing it. And if we miss the opportunity to take advantage of this now, to fund this work, do this research and development, and commercialize these technologies, it will and is happening elsewhere. So it is imperative that we take advantage of this opportunity and act soon. If I can put a little bit of a different focus on another scale on this for an issue I've worked on closely and the need to invest in this work and fund it consistently and in a non-ad hoc fashion, I look at what we've done for Western Juniper in the last couple of years. We're focused on building markets for a species that has significantly encroached, that is viewed as a low-value product that doesn't have much purpose or use. We're finding those uses. We know that researchers have those, and we're trying to commercialize those. But we have to go through proper channels to test those and to certify it. One of the biggest market barriers that we identified in the last year or so here was doing design and engineering values for juniper. Basically, any wood species that you use in a structural application has to go through a process of design and engineering where you test its mechanical durability and how it holds up under structural purposes, exposure to the elements. That goes into the industry trade books that are basically the good housekeeping seal of approval, the Bible of what you can use it for. And it's important because it has to go through that process for use in public procurement processes. Juniper had never done that before, all these years as we've seen it. So it wasn't in those books. It basically didn't exist. We were very fortunate in the last year to get some funding from USDA Rural Development and the state of Oregon through Business Oregon and the Oregon Department of Transportation to do this. So I called up the researchers at Oregon State University, Scott Levingood, and I said, Scott, I've got some money to do this project. And he said, are you serious? And I said, yeah. He said, we've been talking about this for 20 years. This has never been funded. We absolutely have to do this. I want to test it for use in signage for signposts so ODOT can buy juniper for signposts. I want to test it for guardrail blocks. Very simple, straightforward applications that had never been tested because we had never funded it. This center would be able to do work like this in the future so we don't have to go out and get these grants and fund it in an ad hoc fashion. So 18 months from now, I hope to have that information available and use this, build those markets, and generate a lot more revenue in these rural communities for these local species. We can't miss opportunities like this again, and I think that really illustrates it. So I'm thrilled to see this bill in the center being recognized for what it could do. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Beyer, did you want to, since she's on the record here, you can talk any question you want for your mayor.
I'm just following the lead of my mayor here.
So with that, thank you very much. Is there anyone else in the audience who didn't sign up who would like to talk about this particular bill, which is 950? Seeing none, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 950, and we're going to open a work session on 895. Thank you. Senate Bill 895. This is a bill that has a major change in it, and I wanted to get that on the record. We will not be doing anything with it today because we don't have the paperwork, but we wanted to make sure that people knew it and had a chance to think about this before we take action on this bill. So, Senator Hayward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senator from Senate District 17. You have before you the dash five, I think we're up to, on Senate Bill 895. And you will remember that I testified before this committee last Thursday on this bill, and others did as well, about the importance of improving immunization rates in children in Oregon. Since that time, we've gotten some very positive news from the Oregon Health Authority that preliminary data show that we've reduced our non-medical exemption rate by about 20%, which means by about 2 points, or a little less, in the 2014-15 school year, the current school year, which suggests that we're making some progress with the changes that we made with Senate Bill 132 in the 2013 session. As such, this bill contains no changes to the current policy for obtaining a non-medical exemption. Parents who wish to have a non-medical exemption for their child against for any of the immunizations will still have the option of either getting a note from their child's primary care provider or watching an online video module and printing out a certificate that says they've done that. So that still will be in place. The only minor change is a clarification of what was intended in Senate Bill 132, which is what we started with way back at the beginning of session, which is to make it clear that parents who had a non-medical exemption prior to the implementation of Senate Bill 132 will have to go through the process if they've never been through it. So it's just a question of clearing up who needs to go through the new process if they want to maintain their non-medical exemption. And that's the only change. Parents will still be able to opt out with on this process for whatever reason they choose. They can either state it or not. It includes religious, philosophical. I just don't want to. Whatever they choose, it's their choice. The other piece relates to the notification piece. And this relates to the concern about parental choice and parental education. The people who were concerned about maintaining the option of non-medical exemption made the point that they wanted parents to have a choice about what medical procedures their child had. And I heard a lot also from parents of children who were unable to have immunizations for one reason or another medically, or where the parents themselves were undergoing medical treatments that rendered them immunocompromised and thus more susceptible to some of these diseases, or they had newborn babies at home who couldn't be immunized against some of these diseases. And they said it was important for them to have a choice and be aware of what the immunization rates were at their child's school. So this will include the notification piece that we discussed last week. However, in response to a very thoughtful question by Senator Knope last week about whether if a child had been immunized against, say, two-thirds of the required diseases, the diseases that are included, would that child still be included in an overall non-medical exemption rate? To which the health authority answered yes, and he said that didn't seem reasonable, and I thought he had a point. So the new requirement for notification will break it out by disease, because parents are less likely to be concerned, for example, about a child who hasn't been immunized against hepatitis A, maybe, or hepatitis B or something, than they would be against a child that hasn't been immunized against measles or chickenpox, which are much more contagious and concerning. So we thought it was important for parents to have detailed information about what diseases were more likely to be present or at risk in their child's school, so that they had the information they needed to make informed choices. So in summary, and we also heard a concern that we didn't want the schools to incur any cost for this, so we make it clear in the amendment that schools can notify parents in any kind of regular communication they're sending out as long as it's presented in a clear and easily understood manner. So if there's a regular newsletter they send out once a month or a beginning of the school year communication, whatever they do, it can be included in there. It doesn't have to be a separate communication. It can be done electronically or on paper and then posted at the school and on the school's website if it has one. So we're just trying to make information that's already available deep in the recesses of OHA's website available to families at each school and have it be clear which school, what the rates are at that particular school. So it's simply about education and transparency and nothing else.
Any questions of? Yes, Senator Knope.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Senator Dr. Steiner Hayward. So we're going to give this information out, but I mean, are we really giving complete or accurate information as it relates to what parents might care about? For instance, I think OHA has something like 67 communicable disease things that you got to report to OHA for, but only 10 of those are the vaccine related ones. So the other 57 I think would also probably be a danger to immunized or immunocompromised kids, and so we're only giving parents like one set of facts. And I think additionally, as we discussed in committee before, as it relates to adults, there isn't going to be any information on adults. And I think I've either heard you say or maybe OHA say that a lot of adults probably don't have immunity to a lot of the diseases that we got shots for in the early 70s or whatever, because what was thought to have been a lifetime immunity maybe in fact isn't. And so the real question that I have is that we're providing one subset of information to parents, and I'm not sure that that's an accurate picture of everything that relates to the problem that I think you indicated you were trying to solve, which I believe was trying to give parents who have immune compromised kids the opportunity to have information about that. So Could you respond to that for me?
Mr. Chair, Senator Knope, I'll try, but I'm also not quite clear exactly which diseases you might be referring to that would be of concern. I would make the following points. The first is that most of these other communicable diseases require contact tracing, and so were a case of one of these diseases to come up, Salmonella, for example, or E. coli, or anything like that, the health authority, the county public health offices, would be charged by state law with notifying families that whose child might have been in contact with them. Most of these diseases are unusual to see in a school setting. Currently, that's also true of many of the diseases we immunize against, but they are unusual. So were one of these diseases to crop up, parents would be notified in a very timely fashion. A good example of this is the very detailed contact tracing that happened at the University of Oregon with the meningitis outbreak this winter. The Lane County Public Health Department spent an inordinate amount of time doing contact tracing on the kids who came down with meningitis to make sure that others who'd been exposed to them and were at risk of contracting meningitis were treated with prophylactic antibiotics. The same is true for other common communicable diseases that are reportable. So if that's the kind of thing you're talking about, then I think we already have plans in place. The other point I would make is that no parent expects their child to be protected from those other diseases. They do have a reasonable expectation, because immunizations are required by state law with these exceptions, that their child would be protected from these particular diseases. Finally, I'd make the point that most of the diseases that people worry about are much more communicable than most of the other ones that are reportable. For example, the chances of a fifth grader having, for example, some of the sexually transmitted infections, which are reportable, are, I hope, zero. But those are really not communicable through casual contact. Measles, on the other hand, as I pointed out last week, is a very durable virus, lasts in the environment for 48 hours, and is so contagious that 9 out of 10 susceptible people will probably catch it if they're exposed. So I think there's a qualitative and quantitative difference with the rest of those diseases, Senator, and I hope that addresses your question. If it didn't, I'd be happy to deal with the follow-up.
Follow-up. So the one thing I heard you say earlier is it sounded like we were making progress as it related to vaccination rates, which I think is good. So it doesn't sound like there's a real emergency as it relates to this. But as it relates to adults.
I'm sorry. I forgot to answer that part.
I mean, I would think that even if you had a, let's say, a 95% herd immunity at a school, you're only dealing with the children, not the adults, who are much more likely to travel to foreign countries and things like that. And so you may be giving parents a false sense of security as it relates to that, because there is going to be no reporting on adults, and quite frankly, I don't think there should be.
I'm sorry.
How do you deal with that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Knope, I apologize for not remembering to answer that part of your question.
It was a long question.
It was a long question.
Okay.
I did my bestest. Your point is well taken. As I pointed out to this committee last week, it is illegal under Oregon law to require adults to be immunized as a condition of employment. I do not know whether it is also illegal to require them to document their immunity. Your point in the first time you asked the question was that there's some concern about adults not being still immune to some of these diseases. That's primarily true for the bacterial illnesses, and I'll make the distinction that the ones that we actually worry about a lot really are mostly viral illnesses: chickenpox, measles, rubella, or German measles, mumps. Those are the ones that we worry a lot about in a close quarters setting. The only other one that's really of concern, the only two other two that are bacterial and are of concern, are diphtheria and whooping cough, pertussis. And in fact, now adults have a clear recommendation to get boosters for tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis on an every 10-year basis. So my hope is that all primary care providers in the state are following that recommendation and are, in fact, immunizing them, and that teachers or others who are working in settings with children are, in fact, following those recommendations. That being said, I don't think we can require them, but I don't know. At this point, it's probably too late to amend this, and I would hope that educating parents about the children in there would be an important enough step that you'd be willing to support that. I'd be happy to talk about amending it on the House side, should we move it forward, to include figuring out whether we can get information about adults in a school setting. I just don't know the status of current law, Senator. But I would say that the vast majority of the ones that we lose immunity to are bacterial, and there are standard recommendations that we re-immunize adults. I personally am due for another one next year, and hope all of you know, too.
Thank you very much. I see no more questions. So we're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 895. And carry it over to tomorrow.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chair, I apologize. I won't be able to be here tomorrow, so please feel free to call me.
With that, we're going to move on to some of our work sessions and just some explanations of some of them as we go forward. I'm going to just talk a little about Senate Bill 84. I will tell people that this is one that has been exceedingly disappointing to me, because we've had a number of work groups, and Senator Hess has done an amazing job of bringing people back to the table to have a conversation and fix this problem, which I believe needs to be dealt with. All kids in every high school in Oregon need to have the opportunity and ability to take up to 9 hours. I heard this morning one of my other people, up to 15 hours, but I'll go with 9 to begin with, of college courses. Most of our schools are doing that, and I give them a lot of credit. But some of the same people who are in that work group now have a number of amendments. It's making it difficult for me to see the path that gets it all to work. And so I'm not going to carry this one over, because I commit to everyone in this room and anybody that's watching that I will work, and I know Senator Hess has already set the stage, to make sure that we have a bill at next year's session. That's a commitment of mine to get this done. And I have looked into the face of the people who have come up with amendments here at the end and said there will be a bill. It will be this bill if we haven't figured out by then what makes it work better for all of us. So that's what's going to happen with 84. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, I just want to add that I too care much about this issue. I apologize to Senator Hass for not having the bandwidth to deal with a lot of this session. And, my community college, like many others, I think have come forward and said that they have additional concerns. But we need to find a place where those concerns are addressed, because this is too important. Because ultimately, these students are going to continue to feed into the community college system, and it should be a positive for them. And so this needs to be a win-win, and we need to figure out a way to get there, because I think it's imperative that kids leave high school with college credit.
Anything else to add? I guess what I'm mentioning to all the people who have thoughts about things that should be different should have just understood that there were, as a Republican and a Democrat, who really believe strongly that this is the right thing and way to move forward. So just want to put that on the record as well, that this is an important issue. And I think we have bipartisan support to do something. And I wish it had been now, but it's been frustrating. Next will be Senate Bill 322. And Senator Gelser.
No, he just killed him.
Do you want to say something first?
I will. I could say that I just have a constitutional problem with this bill. What I will say is that we are not going to carry this bill over either, and that there are some things that I expect will happen. This is another one that I will watch very closely, because it is, in my opinion, not sustainable, and it has some very, very difficult issues in the future if we don't get a handle on this. And I am committed to finding the avenue for a solution to this. I will say that we talked about this in the meeting. We have a bill that's already in Ways and Means that has to do with fully funding a community college for people. This all of a sudden becomes more imperative to me to solve the problem with regard to the continuing the fifth year programs. So with that,
thank you. So I first of all wanted to thank Senator Hess, because I recognize where this concern comes from. And as I have told the very vocal people in my district who feel very strongly about Senate Bill 322, I have not known anybody to be more of a champion for higher education access than Senator Haas, and I recognize the motivations behind that bill. I think there were the way that the conversation unfolded was very uncomfortable for the people in my district. It made them relatively nervous about moving forward with this bill. I think the fifth-year programs in our districts are really serving kids really well. We've seen some great outcomes. I'm very interested in finding a way to continue them. I think it is a little different than Free Community College. It's a different set of services. I think we need to talk about that more and find a sustainable way to fund it. I've talked with the superintendents in my area who were uncomfortable with moving forward with a legislative task force, and they have committed, specifically Aaron Prince, who is here from the Corvallis School District, has committed to begin discussions about this issue immediately, even meeting before the session is over to start those conversations, to come back with some recommendations for the February session to look at how do we build on what's there in a way that's sustainable, that doesn't threaten the funding of the districts and preserves the good programs that we have and make them available to other people. So I just want to say thank you for that accommodation with giving us the time to do it in that way. And just from my region, this created a lot of communication. So thank you.
Okay. So those two will not be carried over. I want to tell you about one more bill right now that we will be carrying over, and we will be working. It's just late amendments and making sure that we have it right. I'm also working with some people on the other side of the building because this bill is going to have to go to Ways and Means, and I am of the decision, if it's going to Ways and Means anyway, we may want to have a full-time person at the Department of Ed. So I will have that conversation as well, and that has to do with the dyslexia bill because I feel very strongly about it. I think I have the votes on the committee to move that bill, but I need to make sure that we have it in a place where it can move forward and do it in the right thing, and I'm going to have some conversation with people today to see if I can get that extra person, because that may be what really needs to happen if we really want to make it work. So, and I've had some commitments, and I have some shaking heads, so I feel pretty good about that, actually.
If I could, Mr. Please. Chair, and I appreciate that. I think this is important because there's a lot of kids that could benefit from this and not start out behind the curve. It's very clear on that, but I also think, as you and I have had a conversation, there are other front end testings that need to be more universal than they are now, and hopefully we can continue those conversations. I'm talking about making sure that all kids have a vision and hearing screenings before they enter, because if you can't see or hear, you're in a bad spot too. So, and also maybe putting a little tighter scope on autism as well, I think. So, but Mr. Chair, I think those are the things that if we have identified those issues and have addressed them with the kids as they enter the system, their chances of success goes up dramatically.
Okay. Thank you for all that. We are after our time. However, the meeting is not following us, so if you want to do a couple bills, we can do a couple. People can stay.
I can stay till 3.
Okay. We have people leaving, so I guess we can do a couple. I think you can head off, and we have a little bit of time. We'll take a few of the others up. So the first one, another bill that we will do for sure and we will carry over is Senate Bill 875, and I know those people are here, the adrenal insufficiency, but I feel really comfortable that bill will be going in the next session, so we will. So the next one is Senate Bill 759. We will open a work session on 759. We'll have a short explanation, and then we have
Chair Roblin, members of the committee. Senate Bill 759 requires four-year post-secondary institutions that enroll students who receive Oregon Opportunity Grants to adopt written protocol to ensure that students who report sexual assault receive necessary services and assistance. We are considering the Dash 1 amendments to the bill at this time. A minimal fiscal impact has been issued for the Dash amendments, and the Dash 1 amendments, and the Dash 1 amendments have no revenue impact.
Mr. Chair, may I describe that? So you will all remember we had some pretty compelling testimony on this the other day. We wanted to figure out how to tighten the bill up. This This is the bill that talks about how students will receive notice when they've reported a sexual assault on campus. The amendment replaces the bill, and it will require that that each university or college adopts a protocol, and that as part of that protocol, they need to provide a written notification that sets forth the following things. This is where the changes were made: the students' rights, information about what legal options are available to the student, including but not limited to the various civil and criminal options the students may pursue, and any campus-based disciplinary processes that the student may pursue, information about campus-based services available to the student. This part is key: information about the student's privacy rights, including but not limited to information about the limitations of privacy that exist if the student visits a campus health or counseling center, and information about and contact information for state and community-based services and resources that are available to victims of sexual assault. This was a key change because the prior one talked about entering an MOU. This just gets that information out there, and people would enter into those services the same way they would directly from the community. And all of this information needs to be provided in plain language that is easy to understand and in a color, size, and font that are easy to read. In short, it's about knowing what your options are, knowing the difference between a campus disciplinary procedure and going to the police, and knowing that not all of your secrets might be kept secret.
Okay. With that, Senator Knope.
Chair Roblin, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments as presented.
Senator Knope moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments as presented. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Senator, is there any opposition? Seeing none, amendments are adopted. Senator Knope.
Chair Roblin, I move Senate Bill 759 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Knope moves Senate Bill 759 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? Seeing none, it is passed. Senator Gelser will carry this bill. With that, we'll close Senate Bill 759. We're going to open Senate Bill 856, a work session.
Sure.
Yeah. Senator Knope's bill. So,
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 856 establishes Child Sexual Abuse Prevention Instructional Program for public schools. This bill has no amendments. A minimal fiscal impact has been issued, and there's no revenue impact for this bill.
And I'll just state, this is the bill that was Aaron's law that we looked. There were a lot of things that we're already doing, so there's not much they're going to have to do, but there were a few things that this would add to, and we agreed right. That it would be worthwhile. So, Senator Knope.
Chair Roblin, I move Senate Bill 856 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Knope moves Senate Bill 856 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any opposition? Also seeing none, it is. Senator Knope, you want to carry?
Yes, thank you.
With that, we'll close our work session on Senate Bill 856. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill, which was the next one? 790.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 790 requires the Department of Justice to encourage and support services, programs, and curricula to educate and inform students in grades 7 through 12 about domestic violence. We are considering the Dash 1 amendments at this time. The Dash 1s have a minimal fiscal impact, and there's no revenue impact for the Dash 1 amendments.
And this, what do the Dash 1s do?
I sure do. Yeah, so the Dash 1 amendments require the Oregon Department of Education to provide school districts with bilingual posters containing information regarding domestic violence and toll-free hotline telephone numbers so that students may call for information and help. They require school district boards to adopt policies that require the posting of these signs in clearly visible areas.
Okay. Any, Senator Cano?
Chair Roblin, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments as presented.
Senator Knope moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments as presented. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? Dash 1 amendments are adopted. Senator Knope.
Chair Roblin, I move Senate Bill 790 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Knope moves Senate Bill 790 to the floor as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, so moved.
Senator Hansel may want to carry this.
Hansel. Yes, Senator Hansel.
Yes.
We will have Senator Hansel carry the bill.
I only got one left.
What's the other one?
Transfers, and we're not ready because we're not ready for the Thatcher amendment.
Right.
Okay, so that means we're done then, huh?
But we can carry it over.
No, we're going to carry it over.
Okay.
Yeah, we're going to carry over. Do you have a list of which ones we're carrying over? Okay.
period.
So with that, we'll close that work session. Is that one? Is that 790? 790. And we're going to carry over the following bills. Senate Bill 875, Senate Bill 895, Senate Bill 709, Senate Bill 612, and SJR 18. Is there any other business to come before the committee? Seeing none, I thank you for staying a little longer and getting those out of the way. So with that, we are going to adjourn. Thank you. Well, thank you. Well.